cue Henry Mancini, please. It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 298th episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 297 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, www.johnmack13.com. Well, we always have some great guests continuing tonight. I hope you'll be next week and every week at the same time. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some announcements. I am in the middle of the editing of the Hudson Valley Writers Anthology, the collection of the writing of slightly over 60 of today's writers. I am shooting for its release in mid to late November to get it into the hand to people in time for using it as a Christmas gift. Then now some local Hudson Valley news. First and foremost, early voting is going on throughout New York State for the first time. Please check the location and hours of your convenience site. During the pre-election period, you may vote not only at your normal voting location, but at any convenience site. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 23rd year, at 6:30 p.m. in Mahopac Library on Route 6 in Mahopac. More than 175 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has the morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So November's meeting will be on Wednesday, November 20th, at 10 a.m. in the Hill Boulevard Diner, which is surprisingly on Hill Boulevard, just west of Route 6 in Jefferson Valley. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, open to both fledgling and experienced poets, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30, and the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Shrub Oak at 6 p.m. In November, the Mahopac workshop will meet on Wednesday, November 13th, while the Yorktown one will meet in November, 1 week earlier than its normally fourth Wednesday meeting because of the Thanksgiving holiday. So the November meeting will be on Wednesday, November 20th. Finally, the October open mic session of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center will be on Friday, November 15th, in the scenic Poughkeepsie Manor train station overlooking the Hudson in Sleepy Hollow, New York. There will be a featured artist followed by an open mic session. The theme of the open mic will be 1 year before the election, but readers are not bound by this theme. A complete guide to all of the center's many offerings may be found at writerscenter.org. That's writerscenter, one word, writerscenter.org. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. Once again, I hope you'll join us every week at this time for my discussion with interesting guests. Now, to tonight's show, the 298th in the series, my guest is attorney Michael Grace. Mike is an old basketball buddy who served as three-term supervisor of the town of Yorktown, New York, and is now the candidate for Westchester County Legislature. I first met Mike on the basketball courts of the Jefferson Valley Bracket Club, was what must be 35 years ago, and we have been friends. Mike was also the town supervisor of Yorktown a little over 2 years ago when the town board appointed me to my current non-paid position as the poet laureate of the town. The listeners wishing to join Mike and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call of participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hey, John. How you doing? Thanks for the invite. So, how are you these days? A long time ago playing basketball with you.
But that was a long time ago, and since then you had a knee blown out, and I have arthritis all over my hips and my knees, and I have a really fouled up right ankle. So it was a long time ago, as you said. Let's start right at the beginning. So where'd you grow up and go to early school?
Oh, I grew up on Staten Island. I'm a transplant from Staten Island. I went to Catholic Grammar School at St. Paul's, and then Monsignor Farrell High School, and then on to Fordham University and Fordham Law School. My father was a professor at Fordham University, English professor, for about 43 years. My aunt also taught there in the English department as well. My mother was a German refugee from the Nazis and a music teacher in the New York City public school system. And I'm one of...
Well, you're way ahead. I'm still back at your grammar school. Do you remember what your interests and your early aspirations and your earliest aspirations were when you were young?
Oh God, no! I don't know. What did I want to be? I probably still trying to figure that out. So it's always an evolving process, right, for all of us, I think. I envy those who can come into know exactly what they want to be and execute it. Most of us get blown by the wind one place or another. So I went to law school after college and started to practice with my brother, essentially.
What did you major in at Fordham?
Economics and philosophy. Yeah, I was very interested in political philosophy. So maybe that's where the seed was sown for politics.
My daughter went to Fordham, and she boarded there. Did you board, or did you commute from a?
Yes,
from
I in the neighborhood though, 191st Street and Tracy Towers for a year, I think it was. So was that on-campus housing? It was off-campus housing, and I went there. And then when the you're familiar with the documentary "Bronx is Burning,"
I am.
78, yes, that's when I was in Fordham. That was a different world back
then. Yeah, I spent a bunch of time around there. I went to Iona, but I had some friends there. I grew up across Fordham Road in the Inwood section of Manhattan, Island.
That big Irish
island. And I knew the web fairly well.
That was the local spin mill.
Yeah, and also the ice cream parlor, the H around the corner at the end of Fordham Road. I know, as you mentioned, your brother's also the lawyer. Is he younger or older, and did he also go to Fordham?
I've got two brothers. They're both lawyers. My older brother, who I work with here in Yorktown, my younger brother is a CPA, an engineer, and an attorney, and he sells commercial real estate in the city. So we sometimes collaborate on certain matters, but essentially we're in practice with my older brother, who's actually what they call my Irish twin. We're born within a year of each other.
Now, is he the one that I met in Pleasantville that time? Does he live in Pleasantville?
Yeah, I saw that. Yes, sure. My other brother's in Staten Island, so.
Was your father still teaching at Fordham when you were there?
No, my father died in 1979, a long time ago.
Okay.
He started teaching in the 30s. So
my brother was 16 years older than I was, and my brother taught at Iona when I was there, and I had him for theology for two semesters, like a 2 A's, and he threw me out of class once. So.
Yeah, I took my father. I had the pleasure of taking my father. He was very, very good, very well-liked professor of English. So, but he taught at the Lincoln Center campus, and before that, the campus in Lower Broadway, which was 302 or 305 Broadway.
Yeah, so, I opened up the doors of the Lincoln Center campus, and Dean Mulligan was the dean then of the law school. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. They had just moved up. That was the first year, and my brother assumed the principal of power that was right next door, and it was where Kareem Abdul-Jabbar went during his tenure. I know that Jim Monterano, who is a local politician, was in the went to Fordham and to the law school. I believe he was a philosophy major, wasn't he, too?
I think so. Yeah, he's interesting gentleman. We get along very well with each other. Jim.
The father of the close friend of mine was in practice with three of his brothers. They were the only four brothers at the time, and possibly ever, in practice together in New York State. So
yeah.
I don't know how often this. Did you and your brother plan from the start to work together?
No. No, things just kind of evolved that way. I think he was more committed to being an attorney than I was. I kind of did it. I was working on Wall Street at the time I went to law school. So I was working for Kidder Peabody, which was an old firm down on Lower Manhattan. And I had gotten into the law school at night at Fordham and decided to go just to pretty much occupy my time, I guess, more than anything else, and I guess to build some my own personal capital. But I eventually drifted towards being an attorney. I actually ended up with a cancer. I was being treated for about a year and a half while I was in law school. And that kind of threw me off the track where I was employed. And I think that's probably what bumped me into the becoming a lawyer lane rather than staying down in Wall Street.
What were you doing on Wall Street? I was at Dean Witter and at Morgan Stanley, but I was out of the dealing for securities. I was running their IT area for both firms.
Yeah, I was doing their stock clearing operations.
Oh, okay.
Which at that time really hadn't been automated. Now it's automated, but you used to have to settle the books on transactions on a daily basis, and so I was their kind of crackerjack guy to go to when the trading was heavy and they had to go through to see whether duplicate trades or trades that weren't posted, et cetera, that kind of thing.
Was a fellow named Peter Mastrangelo the operations manager then?
I don't know. You're testing my memory.
He was on some committees with me.
Yeah.
Once you got into law school, had you planned right from the start to move from the practice of law into politics?
No. I politics always interested me, but essentially my practice, we do plaintiff's personal injury. So we are litigators. And I had gotten a job up in a firm out of Newburgh running their medical malpractice plaintiff's department for a while. And then we were very successful, which was my demise. I had gotten a very big verdict up in Orange County. And the firm that was I was working for got some backlash for the fact that they had been now involved in medical malpractice plaintiff's work when they were doing a lot of personal injury work that required cooperation with the local medical community. So I was asked to leave with the cases, with a good caseload in tow. And I just happened to be at the time living in Yorktown because that was the halfway point between where my wife was working in Yonkers and in Newburgh. And at the same time, the town was looking for a town attorney. And that was the Nancy Elliott board. And they hired me because I think they felt that they had made some controversial moves and rezonings. And they felt that they were going to need a litigator to protect them. So they hired me. And remarkably, at the time, I was still registered as a Democrat out of Staten Island. And that was a full Republican board that hired me. The other foray into politics before that was in Staten Island, where we had ran our local bartender against Jack Black Murphy, who was a congressman that got involved in the Abscam controversy years ago. And interestingly enough, one of my good high school buddies from Monsignor Farrell is now the district attorney for Staten Island, and another high school buddy was a congressman from Staten Island. So I guess we all kind of got the bug back then. Some of us stayed with it, and it's
interesting. You're a Democrat in Staten Island. That's a very Republican borough. It's the only really Republican borough in New York City.
You know what it is. Back then, it was, you had these Kennedy Democrats, I would say, for the most part, which were the Irish Catholic Democrats, and it was just a natural fit, especially with a mother that was a school teacher and a father that was an English professor. They have very, very, very conservative values, but, we've talked about this before. A different world, when Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill were in office. It was a much more congenial type of time, and there was a lot more in common than there was in, different about their approaches to governance.
Sure, they said that Ted Kennedy's closest friend in the Senate was Orrin Hatch, who talked to him about his drinking, and that and I remember reading that one of William F. Buckley's closest friends, sailing buddies, was John Kenneth Galbraith, and they agreed on absolutely nothing about economics or on politics, but they hung around together, you know.
You departed company on some issues, but you weren't worlds apart. And even if there was, supposedly a progressive agenda on the left, so to speak, it wasn't this complete, wasn't this huge bureaucratic government monolith that was being created all the time or fed. And that was kind of held in check, and there was an idea of charity and compassion for those less fortunate. I think over time, a lot of that got abused, and for a lot of reasons. And now you have a completely different. I mean, I think the Democrats and Republicans, or some of them anyhow, couldn't have more opposite world views. I don't know that they're necessarily, is that an easy reconciliation on some topics. And the approaches to things are completely different these days. So,
when you came here as the town attorney, we were also able to open their own practice then here in town.
Yeah. I had my own practice when they first hired me. I had my own practice, and they actually appreciated it because I was a litigator, so they wasn't litigating anything against the town, so they didn't have any problem. Plus, they were able to get a higher caliber expertise by allowing me to do that as well, because they wouldn't be able to afford it. I wouldn't have been able to afford to do it, and they wouldn't have been able to afford to pay me. So it worked out well. It was a good compromise, and I served very well, and I enjoyed it. I had, it was a great board. I thought they always had the best interests in the town involved, and it was it's been a long time since had that kind of camaraderie, vision, and
did your
execution.
Brother, you right at the beginning, we went practicing together from the beginning here in town?
By practice, I started here, from the beginning I started here. Yeah. And it wasn't transported from anywhere else.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I know that you were the town attorney for a good while. What were the dates, and what exactly does the town attorney do in the town the size of Yorktown?
Well, they're varied tasks. I probably did every aspect of the legal work that was required, which went everything from tort defenses to doing the land use and planning resolutions to keeping the town board on track and drafting legislation. Counsel to the zoning board, planning board, town board. The only thing I did not do pretty much was some labor council work. Everything else I did, it's a very, very varied practice. We defended the town in a federal Clean Water Act lawsuit brought by the riverkeeper over sewer plant Speedy's discharge permit violations. And so it went from that to slip and falls or issues with somebody cutting down somebody's tree you have a wide range of tasks and things that have to been taken care of, reviewing contracts, negotiating contracts. So it was just about everything and anything that a corporation like the town needs legal advice on, which is just about everything. So I enjoyed it. I adored Nancy Elliott. I thought she was great. I thought that board was great. Didn't always agree with them, but I thought they really knew how to manage a town and et cetera, et cetera. So I really, it was a great honor working for them.
at some point you became a Republican, and at the time you got into elected politics, the town that had a Republican supervisor, Susan Siegel, what made you decide to challenge her in a primary?
Well, it's kind of interesting because everybody forgets that I wasn't endorsed by the Republican Party. I mean, the rhetoric these days, you would think that I was nothing but I've been nothing but a loyalist, a robotic loyalist my whole life, and that's furthest from the truth. I ran an insurgent campaign against Susan Siegel essentially because I thought that what was going on in the town was, you know, it was going in the wrong direction. Things weren't getting done. It was mismanaged. And just about everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people just walked across from Town Hall into my office, which is across the street from Town Hall, to convince about what was going on in Town Hall, what was going on, how they were going about things, et cetera, et cetera. So I suggested to the Republican Party, because that's who I had the closest affiliation with, that they ought not to re-endorse her as their supervisor candidate. And so as wise guys, they said, well, you can't complain if you're not going to do something, so why don't you run? And essentially, after that, of all the people, I had a long conversation with Alice Roker. I think it was on the heels of the conversation with Alice Roker that I decided that I would run for town supervisor.
After losing to you, she became a Democrat and won the election for a term to serve as the town councilperson on the board with you. That must have been a contentious relationship, was it?
I have an enormous amount of disagreements with the way Susan Siegel approached things. And I very rarely ever saw eye to eye with her. And not only that, I thought the way she approached things, just conversationally, was always seemed to be confrontational. So we did not get along, and there's no secret that we don't get along. And I think she constantly felt it necessary to write letters every week in the paper with all sorts of innuendo, factual characterizations, this, that, and the other thing. So. Suffice it to say that we were on opposite ends for whatever reason, and I don't think that I've had other races with other individuals, and it didn't degenerate into this kind of relationship that Siegel and myself have, but we don't have a good one. I can't say that's true for other people I ran with. I think other people I ran with, we have a very congenial relationship.
And she lost after the one term there, too, and she has not run for any re-election. You served 3 terms for 6 years as town supervisor. What do you feel your main accomplishments were?
We're very proud. I think we accomplished a hell of a lot, an absolute hell of a lot. And actually, the list is long. Everything from public safety issues, like opening up we got into the town. One of the things we started right away was blue sky planning for storm events, and so we handled Sandy very well. We were up and running as a community weeks ahead of everybody else, and we had our own emergency operations center and emergency protocols, and we instituted the volunteers CERT team, the citizens emergency response team. That was one of the things, one of the things right off the top that we did. But in terms of the finances of the town, we rebid and we drew up new specifications for the garbage contract, which ended up a $800,000 per year savings to the town. And now, just before I left, we did it again and saved the town an additional $500,000, $1.3 million annually on the garbage pickup alone. We ended up reducing the town's long-term debt by over a third, increased the available unrestricted fund balance fivefold, and decreased taxes 2 years in a row, and actually kept them flat over the 6 years. And we were so cash flush in my last year of office that we actually brought in a municipal financial advisor to figure out how to parlay the money that we did have on hand in order to address a lot of the infrastructure needs that we had. And the guy said, well, you know, he comes to towns that are fiscally distressed. He's never been to a town with the situation the complete opposite. We got major grant money. We've millions and millions of dollars of grant money, which actually for every dollar that came in, that dollar didn't go out, so that was a $2 swing. And that I think that translated into almost $8 million. We negotiated with Spectrum Pipeline for the ball fields to be built. We got the Pines Bridge Monument done. We got some of the we had the mall on the brink of an expansion. I think this administration fumbled that. And had I been there a little bit longer, I think we would have gotten the downtown revitalization project done and accomplished as well, which they haven't even touched or brought up. I think we did a lot. We did an awful lot, and I think that was part of my undoing. I think a lot of people just wanted me to slow down more than anything else.
In addition to having your predecessor on the board for one term and facing a primary opponent yourself, what were your biggest challenges?
As a town supervisor, I don't, you know, I mean, I enjoy it. I every time a problem came my way, I mean, I just enjoyed, you know, figuring them out, having practical and pragmatic solutions to those things that faced us, and we got a lot of good stuff done. You know, we changed, you know, I got in there, we changed the whole purchasing order system in the town. We saved us hundreds of thousands of dollars and actually allowed us to do budgets in real time. We resolved all our labor contracts on time, you know, and appropriately. You know, there's a lot of, excuse me, nuts and bolts types of non-unsexy tasks that don't get out in the paper. And it's just the managerial aspects of running the town. And we did it well. We did it very well, I think. And so we were, you know, we started seeing new investments in the town, people actually coming in and wanting to invest in the town, and that stopped now. And I think it stopped because you got a board now that seems to malign those people that come in for the sake of politics. And that doesn't help you at all. You can't, you know, it's kind of funny. They do this economic revitalization board or whatever it is that they, this is what they tout as having, as their pro-business initiative. And it's ridiculous because it's forming a committee that has no clout under town law to do anything or to execute anything, and that's really the function of the town board. And it shouldn't be delegated to a committee. That's what you're supposed to do as an elected official, especially you're supposed to have that vision and execute that vision. And these guys don't have it, and as a result, nothing really gets done. And I think it's been a shame. It really has been. Everything's come, I think, has come to a halt. A lot of the things that did get accomplished, and unfortunately, I think they seem to, they glom on to the successes of which weren't theirs, and unable to execute on new initiatives. A perfect example of that is Granite Knolls. The ball fields, a very complicated and nuanced negotiation over a bunch of years to have that accomplished. And all we got from the opposition is grief, constant ridicule and criticism. It turned out to be a great project. And it's remarkable that they have never even done a ribbon cutting on it, because I don't think they want to acknowledge its great success, because they were the critics and constant critics on the project. But I was very, very proud of what we accomplished. Very, very proud of what we accomplished.
After winning 3 elections and obviously feeling very, very strongly about what you were doing, you were defeated in your bid for the 4th term. Was that very difficult for you?
No. I mean, it's disappointing. It's disappointing in the sense that I think I would have gotten the downtown revitalization project done with the relocation of the highway garage up to the sewers, and we would have gotten sewers done. There's two projects that were really on the cusp of getting done and have been either completely abandoned or waylaid. But that's, you know, that hurts others much more so than it hurts me, so to speak. I really appreciate having my life back over the last year and a half, but near three quarters. It's amazing how much time being town supervisor absorbed in terms of time away from my family, time away from other things in my life. And I don't think you realize how much it detracts from all of that until you stop doing it. So I've spent the last year and three quarters just catching up on my life. And I'm still trying to get to the end of that, but it's so, you know, I have a very full personal life, and it's nice to be able to focus on that and not have to deal with some of the petty foggery that you deal with as town supervisor.
So looking back, is there anything that you wish you might have done differently?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose if I have to be a critic of myself, I did get a lot of, I guess I wasn't considered very warm and fuzzy at times. And I think maybe I probably could have benefited from being a little bit more warm and fuzzy. The problem is that sometimes it's difficult to actually getting things done. You need strong personalities, and leadership requires strong personalities. You can't necessarily, worry about what everybody else thinks or says, because there's always criticism to go around, and you can be stymied and paralyzed and never make decisions. So, part of the liability, I think, of having strong leadership is that you can come off, if you're a strong leader, as being arrogant and not necessarily warm and fuzzy, and probably would have served me a little better to be more warm and fuzzy about certain things.
Probably the two most people who we talk about that had very strong opinions and did come across as warm and fuzzy were John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. But that's unique. That's very unique to be able to pull that off, I think, you know?
For a supervisor, you constantly take unwarranted hits. As for instance, I represented a local business owner, and so somebody thought that was a complaint against me with the grievance committee, and it gets picked up by David McKay Wilson, who is a hack and not a journalist. And it makes the front page of the Journal News, and he talks to a professor at Fordham Law School, who then gives him, a series of hypotheticals that, if occurred, representation may present a problem. But the problem with the hypotheticals, they're impossible to ever have occurred. But that doesn't make any difference, because it's not a story unless you add completely nonsensical hypotheticals to the story, and then. And this is the kind of stuff that you have to put up with, I find that annoying. I had a problem with my real estate taxes for years, because I had kids that had special needs that were not reimbursable by health insurance and cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you have to make choices with your money. I mean, you have to triage what you have and your resources. So you get behind in your taxes. I have to pay a penalty when I made good on the total amount, but that was a choice I had to make at the time based upon my family needs. To make an issue out of that, I find to be reprehensible, because it has nothing to do with my execution of my tasks as supervisor. It has to do with the fact that you just it's just somebody looking to make a personal attack on you. And so that's what you have to put up with. And after a while, it becomes unpleasant, because you – You know, these are your neighbors. Oh, you would think that you're your neighbors, and you have an issue with the, you know, but you have, look, there's plenty of things you can pick on. I have views that, you know, my adversaries can pick on me for, but they're not, you know, don't pick on me for, you know, because I'm dealing with, you know, personal hardships within my, under the confines of my family, my roof, so, you know, I'm very pro-life. You know, a lot of people that don't think that's a, you know, have an issue with that kind of a position. Debate me on that. I would enjoy it. It's an ideological difference, so that's worth having a debate on. Not whether what was going on with my children, and dragging my children into the discussion. So
now you are running for a term as Westchester County legislator. The incumbent Democrat, Mike Capritz, is retiring after many years. The role of the county, the legislature, is difficult for many to understand. New York State has the governor and the two House, the legislature. Westchester contains five cities, each with mayors and a number of towns, each with supervisors, and the county has the supervisor. How many legislators are there, and exactly what are their duties?
Well, there's 17, and they act analogously to the town councilman to the town supervisor, so to speak. So you have the county executive, who's the chief executive officer of the county, and you have the legislative body, which is the county board of legislators. Now, you know, it used to be historically there was a board of supervisors, which made sense. And you will, there's very good and strong argument that county government is superfluous. And to a great degree, it is. I was supervisor for Yorktown for 6 years, and there was very little that I went to the county for in terms of the functioning of the town of Yorktown. And it's probably the same for Somers and as well as Newcastle. So they don't necessarily provide a lot of services north of 287. And you have to, county government really is focus should be on that infrastructure, which requires coordination at a higher level, that's sort of a crow's nest level rather than the town level. So there are situations where towns have to coordinate and cooperate, and you can't do that without the influence of a higher level of government, and that is where the county government comes in. So sewer infrastructure, clean drinking water infrastructure, stormwater infrastructure, park infrastructure, are all things that really aren't conducive to staying within the confines of town-drawn municipal boundaries. So on those matters, county government plays a major role. And then there's other programs that the federal government and the state government run through the county through block grant money. So that's where the county comes in, is to the divvying up that which comes in through the higher levels of government down to where the tires meet the pavement. Well, it should be the least political of boards because it really is a board that administers to this type of, you know, higher level infrastructure. But unfortunately, like everything else these days, it's become very politicized. And I think at this point, the balance of power at the county level, as well as the state, is that there is a one-party system, and you need a check and balance. You really do. You need someone to be at the appropriate point, a voice of dissent or caution when certain policies are put into place. And right now, that's not happening at all. So, I think there is definitely room for that and a need for that. And I think that, you know, that's hopefully the role I'll be playing when I get down there.
It's interesting that Yorktown is split between two legislative districts. I'm not even in your district. The seat you were running for had a Democratic incumbent, and the other district had a Republican. And how much do you think that party designation should play into any of this? Like, I don't understand what county roads are. I know there are some roads that are town roads that at the top of my hill go into Putnam Valley and they become...
Yorktown has no county roads anymore.
Oh, no?
The town took them all over based upon the legacy program, which gave them the legacy ball fields in exchange for taking over the maintenance of the county roadways, which was not a good deal for the town, but that's what happened. But that gives you, there are state roads still here. But, snow removal is a major problem. You got plows that crisscross. You used to have plows that were county plows and town plows and state plows crisscrossing each other. And who would put the plow plate down? I say this five times, Seth. Plow plate down depends on what road they were on. So it doesn't work for an efficient system. But, county government is when they got rid of the board of supervisors, then they created districts based upon population, and that's what you have. So you each have, I think, 50,000, 60,000 residents in each county legislative district. Michael Kaplowitz was a Democrat in District 4, and John Tester was a Republican in District 1. So does party affiliation matter? I think the truth of the matter is that in today's politics, it's all that matters. And I don't know if that's good or bad, but that's exactly what it is these days. It's a polarized electorate out there. Today I saw two mayors from the Democratic Committee out, one which had AOC and the squad on it, talking about the year of the woman, and the other one with Trump's face on it, talking about, now is the time to vote Democrat because it's the Trump, a Republican, coming to foist itself on Yorktown. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous to talk about Trump, as having an influence on Yorktown town politics. But that's the flyers that go out. So there's partisan politics is unfortunately alive and too well in the local politics at this time. And that's, I think, what people vote on. They don't care about anything. Like, what do you think about Trump? And are you a Republican? And, oh, I'm a Democrat. And that's the end of it. I think that's exactly what happened in 17 and a little bit in 18, and who knows if that's what's going to happen in 19.
But both you and your Lanny Gilbert, the present town supervisor, have spoken well about the way both Kaplowitz and Tesla from opposite parties work well together for Yorktown. So can it work?
Yeah, it obviously can work, but very difficult to work if you're launching ad hominem attacks on your other side. Or launching collateral attacks that have nothing to do with the issues. So it's name calling. Got this whole. The whole thing is, I got the local Democratic Party calling everybody racist, including myself. I have interracial kids. I'm a white and I'm a male and I'm a Republican, so I'm labeled a misogynist and a racist, and that's the conversation. And it's terrible, but that's what the conversation. So now I'm supposed to say, oh well, never mind. I guess that's just politics. That's okay. You can call me a racist, and I'm supposed to be sitting there saying, I'll forgive you for it.
No, that's not.
It leaves a poor in the air that's very difficult to cut through sometimes. So hopefully that stops, and the virtue signaling stops, and all this nonsense stops, but that's what happens. And, you know, it's just the same thing. You know, people love to call Trump a racist, and they point to all sorts of things that they say, well, this is proof, and it's all nonsense. You have no idea what the guy actually thinks. And he does, and a lot of what he's accomplished would make him anything but one. So but nobody, that doesn't go into the analysis. You cherry pick what you want to have the analysis to come to the conclusion that you already want to come to right off the bat. So now you're going to have a conversation with somebody after you sit there and you call them a misogynist or a racist or this or that. And, you know, now you're going to have a conversation. So. And then after you do that, and somebody and the other side reacts, well, then they're aggressive and unreasonable because they defend themselves against those attacks, and this is the cycle that goes on, and it's unfortunate. I'll give you a perfect example. I don't have that much more time, but yeah, the Immigration Protection Act that passed the county, which basically, you know, directed county law enforcement not to cooperate with ICE detainers anymore. And the what's really remarkable about it, if you look at what came out of the county committee to the Board of Legislators, was a study that was performed on an Obama administration program called Safer Communities. And the Obama administration Safer Communities program was to take local law enforcement agencies, such as county police, state police, town police, and use them as a force factor in combating illegal immigration. It was an Obama administration program. The IPA, the Immigration Protection Act, actually undermines the Obama administration program, because that's what it was, an Obama administration program. When they surveyed Latino communities in four cities in the United States about Obama's Safer Communities program, overwhelmingly 70% of the indigenous Latino communities were in favor of it. And there's a reason for that, because the indigenous Latino communities are victimized by the illegal immigrants for the most part. They suffer the losses, they suffer the crime, they become the victims of it. But even more remarkably, and the statistic they cited was that 70% of the illegal aliens in these communities were against the Safer Communities Act initiative, which would have caused their deportation. But that left 30% of them that were still in favor of it, which is even more remarkable, because that should have been 100%. But the bottom line is, what purpose did it serve? What did the Immigration Protection Act and telling Westchester County not to cooperate ICE, what purpose did it serve? None. What did happen was, over the last year, two guys who were arrested for child sexual assault and rape were let go out of detention rather than being held for ICE detainers. And imagine being the family of that small child that was your child that was raped by someone, and then going to the authorities, and the authorities telling you they let him go because they didn't hold him for the ICE detainer. And that's the collateral damage in putting forth a program that served no purpose, no ostensible purpose whatsoever, except for the fact that you could virtue signal that you're somehow better than everybody else, and anybody that disagrees with it, because it affects the Latino community, you can throw racial epithets at. And that is what the whole IPA was about. And that's your governance at this time. That's the nature of government. Excuse me, I got a cold. And I think those are the things that you have to be. You know, there's no truth or honesty in it. Sometimes the truth is for you, and sometimes it's against you. But you got to pay attention to it, and you got to pay some homage to it. But the IPA was directly aimed at wounding and decommissioning the Obama administration Safer Communities Initiative. It was not a Trump initiative. It was a Obama administration initiative. But that's not how it got played out in the press and the media. And everybody that was against the IPA was a racist and a Trumpian or whatever it is. And so you get to that name calling and labeling and now you don't have a discussion anymore.
Oh, on a completely different topic, what qualities do you bring to the table that your opponent does not?
I don't need to speak to what qualities he has or doesn't have. I don't know him at all. I met him only once, really, and that was at the Newcastle debate. I probably would have gotten to know him if he showed up at the Yorktown debates, but he didn't. I think not showing up at the Yorktown debates because the party told him not to shows a lack of leadership on his part. You know what? You're going to be called on sometimes to buck your party. Party's not always going to be right. Sometimes the right thing to do, of course, tells you that you've got to tell your party no. All right? Now, he doesn't show up at the Yorktown debates because his party told him not to. It would have been nice because I would have learned something about him. The Newcastle debate was 10 minutes on each side, so I didn't get to know him very well there. I may be an absolute gentleman, maybe an intelligent human being, maybe a very committed one. I couldn't tell you because I really don't know him very well. I've been involved in this community for a good portion of 20 plus years as town attorney, town supervisor, volunteer at the YAC, the SOAC, all these places. I've never seen him. So of all the circles I've traveled, I've never seen him, so I don't know him. I really don't know him. So I can't comment, and I won't, because I think it's unfair for me to do that, not knowing him. As far as I'm concerned, my experience, especially as a CEO of the town, makes me uniquely qualified to understand how to deal with financial pressures, which the county has, how to deal with and come up with practical solutions and pragmatic ones when you have a lot of factors moving against you and you can't just throw money at them, at your problems. And I think that's the big thing that I have. I can see through a lot of stuff very quickly because I've had a lot of experience in doing that, both as town attorney and town supervisor.
To continue down that path, if you could take the chance to speak to voters who have not yet made up their minds, what would you say?
Oh, I tell them, look, you have a choice. You have a choice. I am to the politically right, so that's. But I don't know that makes much difference on the county legislative level. I think the most important thing is that I approach government to be. I think government should be minimal. I think it should be efficient. I certain think there should be a certain efficacy to it that brings results. And so, and I have had an enormous amount of experience in actually accomplishing that, getting from point A to point B, and doing it fairly well. And I think that one of the things you have to consider is what are you going to do? If you do party line vote, you vote for a Democrat. You got Democrats in there. You're adding another voice to the choir that's already there. And so I don't know that serves much of a purpose. Other than if you don't want to hear anything from your opposition, I guess that serves that purpose. But I think that I think we're all better served with a balance, and not only a balance, but I think in my case, someone that actually knows how to get things done. I see myself much more. I've dealt with Michael Kaplowitz for the 22 years that he was down there as in the legislature because as town attorney as both town supervisor. So, and I think what I found very admirable with him, and I think why he served his district so well, is that he actually had a pragmatic and practical approach to things. And very recently, over the last couple of years, had to buck his party to the point where they removed him as chairman of the board. And because he followed some Astorino policies, which he thought were best for the district and best for the county, but the Democrats punished him. And I think that's one thing that people have to keep in mind, that you have this monolithic party that's not going to, it does not deal with dissension very well. And that, I think, is dangerous for us all.
We've touched a lot the basis tonight. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
Oh, I guess that probably about sums it up. I have four children, three grandchildren. I'm very pro-life. It has nothing to do with the county. I am a, you know, I love playing hoops. It was where we met, and I'm a old car enthusiast, and I like to go hunting and fishing every once in a while up in the Adirondacks if I can ever do it. But I haven't, unfortunately, gotten away very often lately. And I guess that's about it.
And you've got a bad knee.
Yeah, back off. John, you know, it's really bad. It's my shoulder. I played on my knee right until 2 years ago. But I started taking shots and thinking, somebody just blocked my shot. And I said, nobody was around me. It's just my shoulder wouldn't go all the way up. So it's really now it's my shoulder more than my knee. And I love the game. I love playing the game. And I miss it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, terribly. So I thought it was a game I'd always play forever. But not it's a young man's game. I guess I was lucky enough to play for as long as I have.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And one of the interesting things is that our orthopedist that was here, Steve Small, has both. He can't play anymore either because he's got a bad knee. So.
Yeah, good guy, good man. No, it's funny, John. I consider you my friend, and I mean that sincerely. And I don't think that we're kind of at the opposite end of the political spectrum in a lot of ways. But I think our friendship is a testament to the fact that we still can all get along with each other very well and have great conversations, and we treat each other with an enormous amount of respect despite our political views, right?
I agree completely, Mike, and thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure, and good luck in the election.
Yeah, thanks, and good luck with everything. I know I'll see you around the block.
Yep. Send any comments or questions to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com. Go to my website, www.johnmack13, for URLs of previous shows, schedules of upcoming shows, and a bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon in both paperback and Kindle format. Now, in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Until next time, as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Now let's go off once again with the Eagles and Taking It Easy. Amazon, play Taking It Easy.
Take It Easy from your library on Amazon Music.
Thanks again, Mike, and thanks for
listening. All
right, buddy.
All right, thank you, too.